You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here with our second week covering our last novel of the year, Nev Marsh's Murder in Old Bombay, chapters 25 to 42.
An explosive finale, you might say.
Finale?
Well, you know, I mean, we're in the second part of this book.
Explosive,
but like,
this almost book penultimate is finale of finale.
You know, look, a lot of crazy stuff happens in this series of chapters. Won't try.
We've made a linguistic mess for ourselves.
It's fine. We don't care about English. We care about the English in the story, but only in the peripheral sense. It's fine.
That's true.
We don't need to worry about our English. That's not important.
You might remember last week on the show, I was talking a little bit about how I was excited to get more into the crime.
Yeah.
Maybe explore the Washerboy's history.
Yeah.
I just wanted to begin by saying I have never felt so upended by a murder mystery in regards to my predictions. Nothing in this stretch of chapters that has anything to do directly with the crime.
I wouldn't say nothing. We do try and investigate.
Emphasis
the
on the
of,
word directly.
Hold on. We try to investigate like the death of Kasim, who is this like servant boy from years back, who died on a train track.
That's a different case, though. That's a different case.
Yeah, but like, still, we go to find a doctor who, as we all know, is the most important character in any murder mystery.
Poor James.
So several doctors. Well, yeah, I mean, we do. There's like a bunch of doctors in this story. There were five doctors, I believe, who worked on the original Framji case. And there's this Aziz guy. There's too many doctors, really, is what I'm trying to say. But you're right. Like, when I first read this stretch of chapters, I found myself wondering, can I even put this on the show? Because the whole second section is traveling around, avoiding getting shot, having post-traumatic, like, nightmares, and maybe giving yourself away. Because our man, Jim, our main character goes deep undercover. He goes full Sherlock Holmes. He goes full native, and he suffers for it. And it's beautiful. Anyway,
yeah. we leave Bombay. We go out to Lahore, where the Afghan and is it Sepoy?
Sepoy, yeah.
Yeah, are about to come to blows. The city gets set on fire, and we trudge into the mountains for several weeks.
It's so
come
awful.
Across a bunch of orphans.
That we save.
Then go on a suicide mission to rescue some military men trapped in a town that's been cut off from supply lines. It's crazy.
It's a regular historical war novel. It's insane. This novel is, as I mentioned, it is one third murder mystery, and we've already had that. It's one third war story, and that's this part, and then the rest of it is all romance. I'm so ready. which I don't know what you want to say about Diana, but she has my heart.
It is incredible to me how absolutely whipped Jim is.
It's great.
Through this story.
It's so good.
I don't know how else to put it. There's like a moment where he's
a mess,
fighting for his life by the side of the road, and comes across this guy selling a young girl and decides to buy her, and makes some comment in there to the effect of Diana wouldn't approve of this. And it's like, dude, you are considering how stabbed you were going to get for trying to rescue this young girl.
I mean,
like, why does Diana matter right now?
He loves her. It's the problem. He loves her and he can't have her. It's the age old romantic problem. And she betrays his trust in the final chapter that we cover today. She thinks that he may have done things with the little girl, which is awful because that's the world that we live in, apparently. But like, she shatters his trust. It's terrifying that she would even consider such a thing.
I mean, there's a really good transition there as well, because we go from the very British wealthy opening portion that we covered last week, and then there's this transitional sequence where Diana starts to get really worried about Jim dying before we jump into him actually going undercover and putting himself in harm's way and exploring more of the Indian side of the story.
That's so good, though.
And that bridge is really smooth and done in a way that feels so direct to those characters, whereas to us, to the audience, it is clearly about setting us up for the transition from smooth detective narrative into war story, basically.
I mean, it's so good that you bring up Diana's reaction as well, because when he's going to leave, if I recall correctly, he ends up just vanishing. He says, I don't think I should say goodbye to her. That would be better for her, which is false. He's an idiot. But she's worried about him physically dying when he goes off and as he's getting involved in the murder mystery. But when he comes back, she says, Have you become that soldier that you pretended to be for all that time? Have I lost the Jim that I knew?
Yeah.
And there's again that thematic of like, Jim is both sides of the coin. And if he tries to adopt one of those sides more strongly, will he lose what makes him truly unique? But yeah, like he switches from, you know, worrying about death in the physical sense to worrying about the orphans, to worrying about Diana. Like these are two sides of his life that are equally important. Losing himself and losing what makes him, that sincerity that you've been talking about a lot, is something that Diana is worried that he'll lose and something that he tries so desperately to hold on to throughout this set of chapters.
The other thing that I thought was really nice about that across every aspect of this stretch of chapters was how well handled serious issues are.
Oh my goodness.
We go speak to the native people of India in Lahore and are put in the middle of their struggle, right? We're still seeing it from Jim's perspective, but he is put into the firing line that the people living there anyway would be. So we get to experience without this like weird filter of separation that we would get if we were still with the Framjis. When we go and deal with the orphans, they show up and accost Jim. It's not him coming in as this like heroic savior. Like he's on the back foot when Razak comes and takes his gun.
It's so and good. Points it at Jim. Because he's an idiot. And it is only his sincerity and his kindness that gets them to back down and hang out with him and call him Baudi, which is father. And I love that. And furthermore, I absolutely love that we don't actually get a proper sit down with Razak until much later on when he takes Razak as a scout to go and find Dr. Aziz and the riflemen that have been trapped. And he straight up asks Razak, like, so why did you accost us that day? Like, what made you, out of all the people you decided, like, why'd you beat me? And they said, well, because you had a woman like making food. You had someone who was making roti.
Yeah.
And so even though the orphans are like dirty and possibly murderous, they just keep the orphans very simple in terms of their device and their motivations, right?
I was so surprised when Razak actually was just able to reunite with his family.
It's great.
I thought we were going to go just straight into the tragedy there, but no, they just show up and end up saving Jim on the way back out from rescuing soldiers.
I love that this story can have these wholesome moments. It's so nice to read a story where it's not just, I mean, we do see him get put through his paces. We do see Jim get kind of mentally and emotionally destroyed, but like there's lots of hope and lots of just wholesome working togetherness in this story, which I always really appreciate when it's earned properly. And I think this story just does a great job of that.
There's also a very strong theme of both rising above your station and the consequences thereof. Mm-hmm. Dr. Aziz, who you mentioned there, the reason he's going after him is because he's looking for the one on record witness of another murder a few years ago in the Framji's history. The way that it is framed is that Kasim, this young boy who was run over by a train, died because he tried to rise up above his station in a way that put him in danger. But we see examples like that through lots of the characters through this story. You know, Razak rising up to lead these orphans, Jim rising up against this human trafficker who he thinks is going to come after him with weapons.
Yep.
It just goes on and on through the story, and it's a really strong undertone through this section.
Like, it's about risk and reward in a sense, right? Like,
yeah.
You rise up, sometimes you get beaten down, but sometimes you point a gun at a man who's secretly a detective and he saves your life. Sometimes that just happens, you know?
Yeah, and then you get to go to the wealthy family's house and look at their horses.
Have a bath and yeah, that'd be great.
Herds, I have a big revelation to unveil.
I'm ready.
In the following part of the discussion, so stick around for that. But we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We're discussing Nev Marsh's Murder in Old Bombay, chapters 25 to 42. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour here on 2SER 107.3. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Hertz here with you. Today, we're in week two of a deep dive into Nev Marsh's Indian historical crime symphony, Murder in Old Bombay. We're thrilled tonight to be joined by another brilliant writer in the field, Vaseem Khan, author of the Baby Ganesh Detective Agency series, the Malabar House series, for which he's recently won the Sapere Books Historical Dagger Award from the Crime Writers Association. And to help us pick our first novel for 2022, Vaseem, welcome to the show. It's so good to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on Chaps. As I was saying to you before the show, I feel like I'm sort of part Aussie because for the last 10 years, my boss in London has been a man from Brisbane, Richard Wortley. I don't know if he listens to the show, but he's moved back to Oz as of last year because of the pandemic. So Richard, if you're tuning in, aloha.
Hey, Richard. I hope he tunes in. Tell him to tune in. Yeah. So, Vaseem, before we get into, you know, serious topics, I need to let you know, I like to take a poke, you know, around the internet to make sure that our guests aren't hiding any skeletons in their closet, possibly from previous murder victims. And I discovered, to my absolute delight, that you have written a detective series involving an adorable elephant in the role of the sidekick. Now, we often say on the show that the sidekick needs to have an intelligence that is slightly lower than the average reader. So, Vaseem, my question for you is, do you think that a baby elephant could solve your average murder mystery?
Well, I'm going to pick you up on a point there because you say that the sidekick should have the intelligence which is slightly lower than the reader, but most have an intelligence that is slightly lower than the elephant.
Oh,
so.
No.
Oh, no.
Is it hot in here?
Goodness,
is
it hot? Me. It's no wonder they call it the Red Hot Chili Riders podcast.
Oh, no.
No, I'm just kidding, of course. Yes, you're right. My first series started with a bang. Not by any plan on my part. I spent 20 odd years trying to get published, writing all sorts of weird and wonderful novels. I didn't think this book was going to get published. You know, by this stage, I'd given up on the idea that I was ever going to get published. And so I thought, you know what? What the hell? Let's just throw an elephant at it. It's a symbol. It's a metaphor for India, and it allows me to add just a strain of humor throughout the books, because Chopra himself is a very serious man and he's investigating serious crime. You know, I saw things in India which made me very, very uncomfortable. So, for example, if you're wealthy, if you're connected, you can get away with anything up to and including murder. And there are famous cases of film stars mowing down people and managing to get away with, you know, slap on the wrist. So Chopra is basically my alter ego, who tries to right some of these wrongs, who tries to make sure that justice is served. You know, it's a lens. It's a lens onto society.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I guess the next thing I wanted to talk about, as I kind of hinted towards earlier, is the Red Hot Chili Riders. I think, you know, your brilliant sense of camaraderie with yourself, Abhir Mukherjee. I guess, as you put it, your words, wit, and wisdom with your audience and some, like, incredible personalities you've had on from the writing world and beyond. For those unfamiliar, how did Abhir's mom become the real star of the show?
Well, wow. you guys are behind the mic, so you know how these things develop, and sometimes sometimes it's a natural chemistry. So Abhir and I have been writing, and our debuts came out very close to each other. We were both writing about India. We became friends, and to be honest, the first time we met each other, he ignored me.
This is hitting too close to home. Can I tell you, the first time we met, we thought each other were complete idiots. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a stable relationship now, but when we first met, Flex and I, we were like,
let's
wow,
be clear, what we both thought I was the idiot.
Well, that's true, but I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to admit to that.
Yeah, well, same here. Me and Abhir both think he's the idiot. But
yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
No, he's wonderful. And as for his mum, you asked about his mother. So what happened was that we didn't have a venue, and we ended up at his mum's house, who lives separate, you know, not too far from either of us. But the clincher was that she offered to cook for us. So we went around there. She cooked for us, and then she was watching us do it. And being an Indian mum, she basically came in and said, "You don't know what you're doing, do you? Let me say something."
That's pretty good. The true hero. Yeah.
Does she think you know what you're doing yet?
No, of course not. No. She has no confidence in us whatsoever.
You know, you mentioned that you were writing for like 20 years before you first got published. When did you first start telling cabbies that you were a writer when they asked you what you did, and what was like the tipping point for you?
Well, to be completely honest with you, I spent those 20 odd years utterly alone. I didn't have that confidence to share that stuff with other people. It's changed now, obviously, over the last 7 odd years. You make friends within the industry like Abhir, etc., and we'll exchange notes and ideas about books that we're writing. I think with all of these things, you gain self-confidence the more that you do it. I think it was Dean Koontz who was on our show a while ago, and he said, writing is like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the better you get at it. And that gives you confidence. So I think that's the main underlying factor. If you do enough of it over enough years, you will develop a level of self-confidence. And then after that, this is something nobody tells you, you need some luck. You need some good fortune, your manuscript to hit the right agent at the right time. and then just a bit of luck after that to get you on your way.
Yeah.
It seems like you've hit that, which is pretty impressive. One thing Flex didn't mention at the start is that you actually work in the Department of Security and Crime Science at the University College London. How many other crime writers do you find calling you up looking for advice on your latest wacky idea for a corpse?
Yeah, you know what? I kept that fairly hidden for a long time because you do end up getting asked a lot. I mean, I just did a seminar for writers on cybercrime, for instance, which is one of the things we're looking at right now. My work is quite flexible now because of the writing's gone really well. So I try and balance the two. But I don't want to leave it because, as you've just hinted, it's wonderful as a crime writer to be amongst these really brilliant people. And as I was saying to you earlier, my boss for 10 years at that department was an Aussie. Do you know the first thing he did? And this is not even a joke. I know this is going
to
sound
incredibly
stereotypical. He came into the office. The very first thing that he did was he bought a barbecue and put it in the back garden of our office.
Oh my goodness.
That's a good choice. It's a good choice.
It's a good gift.
He refused to allow anyone else to operate the barbecue because apparently we Brits do not know how to barbecue.
I'm not gonna stake a claim on that opinion, but I have heard it before, so maybe there's truth to it. Maybe there's truth. I have faith that you could learn that.
I mean, with enough practice and a little bit of luck, anything's possible, right?
Yeah, I guess to end us off today, we wanted to launch 2022 with one of your own award-winning novels in the Malabar House series, but we're at a bit of a stalemate at the moment because the gimmick on the show here, if you're unfamiliar, Vaseem, is that we read these novels almost competitively to see who can get ahead of the text and who can solve it. So one of us reads the entire novel ahead and one of us stays behind to kind of read along with the audience. But we're at this stalemate because we don't actually know which of us will be the one solving it at the start of next year. So we wanted to ask you which one you think would provide the more challenging start to our 2022 Murder Mystery World Tour. Ooh.
So the two novels in the Malabar House series is Midnight at Malabar House, which launched the series, and just to put it in context for your listeners, these books are set in 1950s Bombay, just a couple of years after India became independent from the Raj ended. And there were a million people died during that partition era because Hindus, Muslims and Sikhs were pitted against each other during this horrible event. And into this mix, I introduce India's first female police inspector, Persis Wadia. In my personal opinion, I think you'd have more fun with The Dying Day. Midnight at Malabar House won the Crime Writers Association Historical Dagger. But if you're looking for something that's a puzzle to do alongside your readers, The Dying Day has been called The Da Vinci Code Meets Post-Independence India.
I think I've seen that quote, yeah.
And the reason for that is that when Persis begins to investigate the theft of this incredibly priceless manuscript, she discovers a series of coded riddles written in verse.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, Flex would love that.
So you have to work out what these riddles written in verse, and they were a real git to write, I have to be honest, because I had to not only try and connect them to Bombay and to the clues, but I also had to make the damn things rhyme. So, yeah, it should be a bit of fun.
Herds, it sounds like you're going to be the one solving this one.
I have a question. I'm happy to. This sounds like fun. Flex would eat this for breakfast, let's be honest. As complicated as it is, Flex has a mind beyond his ears. Vaseem, I have a question. What are you putting on the table? What do I get if I solve this Da Vinci masterpiece? What is on the table? Is it your love and respect? Is it a baby elephant? What do I get?
Well, I'll be happy to send you a baby
elephant. Tell us right now. Sorry.
Well, I could give you my best Aussie joke.
Oh, we'll have to earn that though. He has to earn
we'll
that.
We'll definitely have to. Hold on to that joke now.
No, we're going to read through both of these books. I'm going to get Herds to solve The Dying Day.
It should be good.
And we'll hopefully have you back on for that best Aussie joke at the start of 2022.
I'll give you a teaser. What's a kangaroo's favorite music genre?
Is it hip-hop?
Hip-hop, yes.
Yeah, sorry, I stole that one from you. Just like I'm going to steal the solution to Dying Day. There we go. Got him. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Vaseem, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. We will have links up on the podcast to his work, both series we mentioned and the upcoming collection, The Perfect Crime, which we didn't mention today, but we definitely will next year. It has been so good speaking with you, and we cannot wait to hear more about Malabar House when we kick off with it next year in 2022.
Thank you, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much to your listeners for tuning in.
You're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3. More historical Indian crime fiction coming up as we continue. Stick around. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your murder mystery world tour. We're discussing Nev March's murder in Old Bombay, chapters 25 to 42 today. And Herds.
Flex.
I'm in an interesting position here. As we established at the start of today's show, I have never been so upended by my predictions of what would happen next in a text.
Finally, I've caught you with one. You will never solve this mystery.
I may yet walk away very scathed from this incident.
Look, honestly, as I've said, like, there are not that many clues in this part of the story. Let's see how well you can solve things and figure out what's going on here, because you may walk away with points.
I think,
regardless, we'll see.
Comfortably, I have at least understood the story.
Sure.
It is very sketchy as to whether I have solved the crime. I think I can get there, and I wanted to start with what I described to you before we recorded today, Herds, as a grand revelation.
I'm ready. I haven't heard this at all. I don't even have a clue where you're about to go with this, so I'm excited.
Herds told me not to tell
him. I got my popcorn.
Now, while I was reading through this, and it sounds like you as well, Herds, the first time, just had no idea what related to the core of the story going through this weird war story side adventure, it felt like.
Okay.
But I was sitting down while I was preparing to cook dinner today, Herds, and it suddenly clicked with me.
Yeah.
The whole reason we go off on this journey is because of the parallels in the story.
Ooh, interesting.
This entire adventure starts because Jim reads a letter from Adi in the Chronicle.
He's inspired, right?
And he sees in that his own past of being the one left behind by the people he's lost. But I realized, Herds, that there is another character in the story who goes on a journey somewhere else to try and understand things, to try and learn things away from their home place. And it's Diana.
Ooh!
She goes to Britain to study.
Are you telling me that Diana is the greatest character in the novel? Is that where we're going with this?
Clearly, with this parallel, Nev March has completely under the radar the first time through for me, sculpted this story where we are indirectly living kind of what happened to Diana.
Cool.
Which either means that we're just talking about how they're compatible as characters and, oh, yay, the romance will come together and they'll sail off into the sunset at the end, I'm sure.
So screw you, Dad, and they'll run away together. It'll be great.
Now, listen, it's a family story. They're going to get approval by the end. Mark my words.
We'll have to see.
But I think what that means in a mystery sense is that the same thing has happened here. We go on this story of Jim going out, finding out about another culture, and then rescuing a bunch of people, and it's about how he comes back changed at the end.
Sure.
And I'm wondering here, and my theory is that Diana has gone off to Britain, made a whole bunch of relationships with, you know, characters off the page over there, but has come back with a burden in the same way. And I think Akbar might be the burden. We've had this character, Akbar, who I thought in no way could be the culprit because they were essentially a throwaway suspect mentioned in our original lineup at the start.
Sure.
They don't even appear on screen until like a party midway through the last bit in Bombay.
Yeah, here. It's suspected that, is it Suleiman, the prince guy, might be Akbar? That's like the suspicion right now that Jim has. You subscribe to that theory then?
I think the setup here is essentially that Akbar is, as you alluded to, probably a member of this wealthy family. If he is part of that family, then he has ties to the burglar, or could even be the burglar that broke in to the Framji estate.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In the book, Jim, like, he seems to think that the prince, Suleiman, is the burglar and, like, is Akbar. That's something he, like, considers.
That is pretty much what I'm leaning on. Like,
okay.
I'm thinking probably that in some way, Akbar, or Nur Suleiman, is blackmailing the Framjis, likely directly Diana, over their past relationship, you know, maybe trying to take her hand in marriage, and her pushing back against that is the, like, crux of what got the other two ladies killed at the start of the story.
Sure. I don't know. Do you have any specifics on what that blackmail might be? Is that just, like, blackmail's been mentioned in the story? That's probably what's going on. Because I'm not sure how that leads to these ladies being killed.
Especially
since, like, Diana lived with these ladies, and if they were killed by Akbar, like, what's going on there, you know? That seems a bit messy to me, you know?
Like, it is, as we mentioned last week, exceedingly obvious that dark secret that Addy and Berger were discussing is what is in the blackmail. I just don't know what that is.
Look, I can see you using thematic content of the story to justify your theory, which I approve of personally. Yes, I'm a big fan of what's going on here. I'm definitely glad that I decided to lead on this story, because watching you try and solve a crime that has less physical clues, I think, is a little bit more challenging than... Because, look, we've seen in the past, you look at one physical clue, one technical clue, and you leap at the answer immediately. That just happens.
I know. It's what I'm good at.
So I'm excited to watch you try and grab at thematic straws trying to put something together. Because I do think there's enough clues so far in the story to figure out most of what's going on. And I think you've touched upon some things that are very, very close. But I would love to see you nail the hammer in.
Yeah, I think to try and fill a moment while I think here on my feet.
Look, that's what I'm doing.
I think that in general it's really interesting here, because so often on this show what ends up happening is we pick novels that are hard to ourselves, present them to each other, and they're incredibly easy. Whereas I think what you've done here is picked a book that was probably easy for you, thrown it to me, and I'm like, oh, no.
I mean, look, I would have saved it for you to pitch to me, but I enjoyed reading it too much, so I finished it, and here we are.
Yeah. I think I'm hopeful, at least, that you'll be generous enough to give me a point for this week, but I mean, you
put forward two theories, right?
Oh, yeah, so you got one point for last week, effectively.
Look, I don't want to spoil it. I won't spoil my deliberations, but I'm going to have to read through these chapters again to the end to tell you whether you're getting the full 3 points or just two points.
I am frantically racking my brain trying to figure out what this last piece is. I thought
you might have cracked it when you said you had a revelation. I thought, oh, has he done it?
Well, the thing is I feel like I've hit on the right device, and that was what I was hoping I could bring today to the show, is bring the right device to find the answer to crack the nut.
The nut. The Indian nut. That's all right. I think unless you have a sudden flash of inspiration, I think that might be it for this
Let me just say the final theory out loud so I can try to get
craziest,
it all straight.
Here we go. Here comes the crazy theory.
So Akbar is Suleiman and killed the two girls over this blackmail that had something to do with the Framjis' grim secret. Kasim is probably, like, at the crux of it in some way. You know, maybe he leaked the information, or because we know that the body on the train tracks wasn't his, but it's still heavily implied that he died, as far as I can tell. The link there is something to do with Kasim's relationship to the family. You know, he was...
Well, he specifically was following, I believe, Pilu around, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah, I think that Diana's history in Britain has something important to do with that particular connection there, but I cannot figure out the piece of blackmail right at the center of it.
Yeah, that's okay.
So I'm gonna fold for perhaps the first time ever on Death of the Reader.
Yes, I win. Well, we'll see how I think you did next week, but you know, it's been fun. It's been interesting watching you struggle with a novel for once in the 3 years we've been doing this.
I think we finally were brave enough to give each other stories that we were good at ourselves.
Yeah, that's okay. Maybe that could be our theme for next year.
I have a different theme for next year, but we can talk about that over review season.
Anyway, I guess that'll do us for this week. This has been Death of the Reader discussing Murder in Old Bombay by Nev March.
Hell yeah. Next week, chapters 43 to the end, and that'll be, my goodness, our last episode for the year. I'm terrified, Herds. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us here on your Murder Mystery World Tour. We will see you next week with more of Murder in Old Bombay.
This is Tour CR 107.3.